is the Kevin Shee Show.
Welcome to the Kevin Shee Show. We're still in the midst of the coronavirus, but although a lot of things are lifting up, we're not allowed to travel yet, so I'm pretty stuck here learning different things like motorcycle, jet skiing, and just reading up, catching up on my reading. Today we have a special guest, Nick Ho from HPA Architecture, to talk about One Belt, One Road. One Belt, One Road is the initiative of our era. It has a big impact in Asia. So let's tune in.
Welcome to another episode of the Kevin Shee Show. Today we have a very special guest, Nicholas Ho of HPA Architecture Firm. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Can you give us a bit background about yourself and your company?
Sure thing. So HPA is an integrated consultancy business, primarily in architecture and planning. So we founded 40 years ago. Our headquarters is in Hong Kong. But today we have done projects in about a dozen countries, and we have 5 offices globally. So
wow.
I'm a second generation.
So you're an architect as well? You study in the UK?
Yes. Unfortunately, I got scammed into studying architecture by my father. So I'm at my 10-year mark now in the business.
So did you enjoy being an architect, or you would have taken a different route if it's not for your father?
Well, I think in retrospect, many people will probably say, you know, for any individuals, you probably choose something else. For me, I enjoy architecture a lot. I enjoy the design process. I enjoy seeing things get built and people living in it, using it. But I think moving forward, just purely as a project level consultant would be very difficult, just because the landscape of the business and the industry is very, very tough right now. And I think going forward, probably a lot more integration with other services horizontally or vertically would have to happen.
Right now, we're in the middle of a COVID virus affected the global economy. Is your firm affected by this virus? How is it affecting you, the industry?
I think for architectural industry, for example, because a project lead time is usually 3 to 5 years, so it's not that easy to disrupt a project if a virus is here for about half a year or a year, because ongoing projects which has already been leveraged, or during construction, or they sold units, or they're rushing towards the selling phase, they will have to keep the project going. And because interest rate is so low nowadays, so I think the sort of barrier for them to be disrupted is actually quite high. It's not easy to get disrupted. And I think for us, we're quite lucky because this year, or these past 2 years, a majority of our income actually comes from Hong Kong. And majority of that actually comes from the Hong Kong government contracts. So these contracts are very stable, it's long term. So, you know, we're quite lucky because sometimes, you know, in the past 40 years, sometimes we have majority in mainland, majority Hong Kong private sector, majority overseas. So right now it's majority Hong Kong government. So then it's quite lucky with that way.
I see. The topic of today's podcast is about One Belt, One Road. I understand you've been very active with the government to promote One Belt, One Road around Asia. Can you give us a brief description of what One Belt, One Road is and what's aimed to achieve?
Sure thing. So in my humble opinion, I think Belt and Road Initiative is very much about connectivity, connecting the people, the software, connecting the culture, physical connectivity through railway, sea route, flights, and also digitally through 5G, through data cables, through the tech community, so on and so forth. And I think because China or mainland has huge amount of experiences and also technology developed in the past 30 years. So these sort of experiences becomes very valuable to developing countries along the Belt and Road, especially for them to unlock these countries' potential. Because through building different types of connectivity, you can really release the potential of a developed country or developing country or underdeveloped country. So more people from around the world, more companies from around the world can go into these sort of unlocked potentials, countries, and start investing and start developing and benefiting from the sort of advantages of this connectivity.
So in terms of the land road, I assume is high-speed rail or traditional rail or highways. They'll be built across all the way from western part of China, maybe Guizhou or Yunnan, all the way to maybe Europe. In terms of sea, I guess it's building more ports and harbors for more shipping lines to go in. And digitally, is 5G connections and all these digital like hubs that empower these countries to have a much faster internet speed. Yeah. Am I approximately right about that?
Absolutely.
And the big question is, most of these countries are quite developing or not very strong financially. How can they finance these projects, or is China paying for the bill? Is that gonna have a huge burden for our country, China? What's your take on this?
I think you're absolutely right. I think for these underdeveloped or developing countries, they couldn't afford these sort of kickoff or kickstart capital in order to do these connectivity, in order for multiple global institutions to get in, because someone has to kick it off. And the kicking off part is usually a huge amount of capital, and the return period is very, very long. So I think there's definitely a risk on the financing point of view. And not just policy banks or commercial banks from China is actually funding these projects, but they try to form a global alliance of institutional financing platforms to join in as well. So IFC from World Bank, and also Asia Development Bank and AIIB, so on and so forth. But I think, institutionally speaking, obviously, a lot of these organizations are responsible to create that kind of funding atmosphere in order to open up new market opportunities. But down to the very, very project, you know, nowadays the world is changing so fast. Developing countries is facing immense challenges. You know, COVID-19 is a huge, you know, wake-up call for all of us. And I think going forward, financing needs to be very flexible, and the feasibility will have to account for things or account for that adaptation that we can't control everything, because a traditional project is no longer a traditional project because of the world is changing so fast. So I think flexibility in terms of financing structure, and also the business model or the feasibility of that single project will have to be heavily scrutinized or revised or developed in order to be fully funded through the Belt and Road Initiative.
When did the One Belt, One Road Initiative start? And have there been already some infrastructure or some things built already that are starting to receive payback already? And how long do you think this One Belt, One Road Initiative will require for majority of the things that they say is going to be built? How long time frame are we talking about?
So I think Belt and Road Initiative is really a master vision created for the world to join in and buy in and help unlocking the world's hidden potential around or along the Belt and Road. So they don't have a fixed timeline, but my guess is that it would be around 30 to 50 years until all these connectivity are fully built and all these sort of hidden potential are fully unlocked, not just by a selective group of countries, but like by everybody on the planet. I think, you know, since 2014, this initiative roughly started around 2014. And there are many projects that's already built in developing countries like Sri Lanka, for example. The seaport project with about 500 hectares reclamation is built already. And many sort of tourism industry, residential service apartment, sort of start to build up momentum there. So we start seeing some actual results in Sri Lanka, in Colombo. And if you look at connectivity in terms of railway or highways, you know, all across Southeast Asia, we see highways and high speed railway being built in the past 5 years. Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, yeah, even Thailand. So I think these are very measurable results. But obviously, this year is a tough year, but not just for Belt and Road, but for everybody, because you know, staying at home, cutting down on global flights, global transportation, and also global trade has been put on hold an argument can be made for about 6 months. So I think this year will be tough, but the broader picture and the broader macro vision is still there. And building connectivity, whether it's physical or digital, has never been more important.
Right now, the U.S.-China tension is very high. And I understand that the U.S. is not very supportive of the One Belt, One Road initiative. Is that going to be a challenge going forward without like full Western or U.S. support? What's your take on that?
Well, I think U.S. and China has entered into a sort of cycle of Cold War. Up and down, but it would be a long Cold War that we were seeing. And obviously, between the two countries, there's a lot of developing and developed countries surrounding the APEC region or the Belt and Road. And I think U.S. is very much focusing internally, making their sort of resolving their own issues internally or making their country stronger internally. So externally, I doubt U.S. is doing much in terms of foreign policy, apart from strategic, you know, military applications. But for mainland, I think it's a very much broader and a much more extensive, not just aid program, but also a economic foreign policy to collaborate with developing countries to get more people to fund these countries, not just from mainland, but from everywhere to fund these countries and help these countries develop and offer them technology and experiences and share the sort of market success when such economies open up. So I think these efforts from mainland won't stop, obviously, because in light of the coronavirus, this would also put a hefty toll, not just on the U.S. market, but you know, mainland and the rest of the world as well. So I think the speed and the numbers of projects will probably be affected going forward in the next 12 months. But down, I think, gradually speaking, or holistically speaking, mainland vision on global partnerships and global economic collaborations has never been stronger. And I think in COVID-19, you can already see, you know, through China Aid Program, through experience and technology sharing on fighting the virus, China has always been very active on foreign collaboration. Whereas, you know, in the U.S. it's a slightly different objective. They're trying to provide for themselves first, I guess, which makes total sense. We, you know, I think every country has a responsibility to provide for their own country. But I think China, you know, because of the vast population and the productivity, we can afford to help others while help ourselves.
Okay, I see you always traveling around the One Belt, One Road countries, giving speeches or joining their events. What do you do there? Do you promote Hong Kong? What's your role when you attend these events?
So I wear a few different hats. I represent Hong Kong at APEC for business advisory. I also do a lot of trade-related missions for Hong Kong government in terms of promotion in foreign countries, and especially along the Belt and Road. But I think my take is that Hong Kong has a role to play, whether it's Belt and Road or whether it is in APEC or whether it is in the global setting. And my focus has always been very strong, very adamant to promote what Hong Kong can do for the world and what Hong Kong people, what Hong Kong talent can do to help and to facilitate deals with the rest of the world. Because not just our professional services industry, our tech companies, our financial markets, our legal system, our arbitration platforms, our talents or youth or culture is something that's worth promoting. So for me, you know, outside of Hong Kong, I'm basically a salesman selling Hong Kong as a promoter. But I truly feel like Hong Kong has a big role to play.
Would it be fair to say among all the One Belt, One Road cities or country, Hong Kong is the most westernized in the sense that we can get capital from fundraising, arbitration, legals. So Hong Kong is one of the most in sync with the Western world in terms of that. Would it be fair to say? And that's our purpose, like in this whole One Belt, One Road initiative.
I think it's fair to say that. I think it's very international. Hong Kong is very international.
International,
because and because it's very diverse, but at the same time we have international recognized platform standards and structure in place with a good sort of tax system, with a good legal system, and this sort of sets the scene that, you know, international capital, international companies would love to do business here, and obviously we have a very strong connection with mainland. And also obviously mainland capital and mainland enterprises. So it becomes the perfect place to do deals naturally. But again, you know, not many deals are done physically nowadays. So if it's done elsewhere or digitally, will Hong Kong still have a role? I think that's also something that the Hong Kong government is also actively thinking about. I think physically, you know, we have benefited from that, you know, global platform for decades, but going forward, you know, nowadays people don't fly anymore. How can Hong Kong still benefit? You know, what's our role to play? And I think that's something that not just the government but many companies are looking to transform, you know, their role digitally.
For an entrepreneur, just say from Hong Kong or China, which country or which city along the One Belt One Road initiative do you think holds a lot of potentials in the next 5-10 years? Is their legal structure okay enough for you, for us to invest in there and you know, not get ripped off? What are some of the potential countries that you see like in the near term?
Sure. So I think Belt and Road countries, these are not new countries or new economies. These countries have been around for like decades or centuries or millennia. Yeah. And Hong Kong or mainland businessmen or businesses have done deals or business in these countries way before the Belt and Road, right? So Belt and Road started in 2014, but many of us have done business in these countries way before that. But I think for us, we are quite bullish on ASEAN region, purely because ASEAN has a very close physical and cultural connection to mainland and to Hong Kong. And ASEAN has a lot of overseas Chinese that has business in both ASEAN region and in Hong Kong region or mainland region. So I think that reciprocal relationship becomes a natural first step for us to focus on the ASEAN markets, because it's, you know, it's quite close. It's like 4-hour flight max. And then it's culturally is not too different. There's a lot of overseas Chinese there, and ASEAN enterprise usually have investment or properties in Hong Kong and in mainland. So we focus on adding value to mutually, you know, how we can add value to them and vice versa. And I think in these countries, because language is not so much of an issue, and we can and we understand these markets quite well. So we quite like them. So I think for us in ASEAN, our focus is like Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, and also Vietnam.
Does these countries still need Chinese support? I understand, you know, they've been doing pretty well the last 20 years already. I mean, obviously they're still developing countries, but is China still like helping them build a lot of things? I see Zhongtie, right, a Chinese construction company, helping them build a lot of buildings, but I assume those are like just market price contracts. They're not like subsidies or grants or anything, right?
Yeah, so I think ASEAN, definitely a lot of mainland companies and Hong Kong companies are very involved in that area, joint collaboration in most cases. In terms of construction industry, I think it's a bit of both, because obviously Chinese contractors, when they go overboard, go overseas because of the vast scale and the vast you know, sheer size of the company, they have a lot of resources that they can pull. So their cost is usually more competitive. But at the same time, they also offer a more flexible construction approach, because sometimes when in these developing countries, let's say, for example, Indonesia or Malaysia, some landowner or developers or government, they would rather if the contractor can fund part of the construction as well.
I see.
And become a partner. But local construction companies in, let's say, Indonesia or in Malaysia or in Philippines, they may be reluctant to do so. they may be less flexible to do so because they're not as big financially, they're not as big in terms of technology or experience wise, so they don't know how to do cost control as well. So I think that's where Chinese state-owned contractors comes in, because not only they can construct diligently, they can also fund, become a partner and fund part of the project.
We always say that Hong Kong talent is losing their competitive edge. Maybe like some of our elders, if they go to China like 20, 30 years ago, they're highly respected because of their knowledge and they're just from Hong Kong. But now there's a lot of key local talent from China that's overtaking that and overshadowing us. Do you agree with that? Is it hard for like a talent in Hong Kong to go to China and make it, or maybe go to One Belt, One Road? And how can we strive in this new ecology?
I think that's probably true. I think Hong Kong has a lot of good talents, but unfortunately, I think in the past 10 to 20 years, part of the population has been very inward looking. We're not able to look externally as much as previous generation did, which is not good or bad, but just a phenomenon that we focus more internally. But because of that same reason, we lose our global competitive edge, not just global, but regional competitive edge. Whereas in mainland, because competition is very, very fierce, especially in the Greater Bay Area. And we see, young and very competitive, very, very good talent there. I think ASEAN region, also similar things are happening. But the best or the most talented individuals from Hong Kong, I truly believe will always, be as competitive and on par with the best in mainland or the best in ASEAN or the best anywhere. But is that best talent in Hong Kong in terms of numbers shrinking? Probably by percentage. But
it's tough out there. The bar is lifted very, very high.
Yeah, because Hong Kong is still a competitive city at the end of the day. So the best in this city will always be able to compete elsewhere. But I think as a general population, we're not progressing or evolving as much as we should have compared to other cities.
I think because Hong Kong has it very well the last 20 years, because U.S. interest rate is so low and we're so close to China that the GDP is going so high. So a lot of people who made it in the past is just relying on their properties, to continue to give them more and more ever income. So they don't really innovate. They're just, living off their golden egg, just like many Middle Eastern countries where they have oil and then they didn't care. Right. So I guess it's a curse if you're blessed for too long sometimes.
Absolutely. You get lazy. It's an inertia and it's very difficult to overcome after a period of time.
What do you think of the office and retail sector in Hong Kong? You think the virus is going to have a lasting impact? Retail, for sure, everybody's doing e-commerce, but office?
I think it's too early to tell. I think grade A building in grade A location will be fine. But grade A in grade B location or grade B building in grade B or grade C location, that might be trouble.
Oh, okay. Okay, because grade A is top talent, right? They rather pay more space to meet the client and all that. They don't care. It's a very small cost compared to the money they're making.
Because grade A building in grade A location like Central, I mean, IPO, you're going to have an office there even for advertising, right? So I think that demand will be there. But do they need grade A or do they care that much or things like that?
Exactly. So if my listeners are interested to contact you, maybe to build a skyscraper or something.
How can they reach skyscraper to a house, that's okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, how can they reach you? Is it on LinkedIn or a website?
I'm on LinkedIn. And we have a website, www.hpahk.com. All our contact information is inside. We're also on social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram.
And your LinkedIn is Nicholas Ho, right?
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on my show, and I hope to talk to you again.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks for listening. For details on this episode, go to kevinshee.com. That's Kevin, SHEE.com.